Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The main team.
Mega Bears fan.
Welcome to Polycast 432. I'm Makalua, and with me today, Canis Albinus.
We saw the eclipse. It was nice.
I think I'd use stronger words than nice to describe that.
It was amazing, yeah.
Thank you. And the Mian team.
If your military units aren't solving your problems, you're not building enough of them.
Yeah, we're supposed to build the 8-axe wonder every time, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can mix it up and build archers or other things as well. It's okay. There's options.
Mackie is joining us from a mobile hotspot today, showing her dedication to the cause.
Well, more like not getting things explained to me about when things can be connected and then disconnected and reconnected. Thanks,
doxed.
ISP, I'm not going to name.
Mackie's been doxed. We can use this information to triangulate that she's in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
How's the Sargasso Sea, Mackie?
What?
The Sargasso Sea.
Salty.
Yeah, it's the part of the ocean of the Atlantic in the kind of in the middle of the Atlantic where the water is kind of stagnant because there's no ocean currents moving it around, so it kind of just accumulates big patches of like sea moss and stuff.
Cool.
Also, looks like my neighbor's lawns all did until everybody got mowed earlier this week. Got you.
Yeah, kind of like that. All right, and we will now start with the topics. We have feedback for the first time in many, many months. Did I write down? I have the text here, but did I write down who wrote it? No, because I am a complete and total amateur. Well, if one of you would start reading the comment and what it's in relation to, I'll find out who wrote it.
Okay, the feedback was from episode 428. As Candace find out who told us this, was I think the point behind the paper was actually something you pointed out earlier in the episode. The Inca were a mountainous civilization. The Maori were largely naval, as were the British and the Japanese. There's been a variety of tech and cultural progression paths civilizations have taken throughout history, and Civ only represents one of them. And it's a vaguely European one, with the problematic parts vaguely filed off. As someone who's a big fan of the vibe of alt history, I've always wanted to do, say, sea studying in Civ, mountainous Civs, Civs that live in heavily forested areas. Some of these become possible with gimmick leaders in Civ 6, but none of them have quite full support from the base game mechanics. Hell, let's look at the recent developments. There's several technology paths we haven't taken in recent history due to specific real-world incidents that changed the path civilization developed along. If the Hindenburg disaster never happened, we'd be making way heavier use of airships now than we are in real life. Airships, even with their utterly crippled technology development, are still more efficient than ocean ships in certain roles. Had the Hindenburg not happened, we'd been improving that technology. How different would the information era look in a world where airships progressed? And if Chernobyl hadn't happened, we'd be using nuclear, well, way more than we are now. I'm going to add also in the U.S. Three Mile Island.
Yeah.
If crony capitalism hadn't beaten out social democracy in modern governments, tech would be different. And this is all just recent history. Go back further, the world would diverge further. There's a version where trains are an extremely heavy focus and the military is focused entirely around trains. There's one where the Navy is the only thing that matters. And that's just tech variety. The topic I think they were needling at, what was being voided in this episode, was cultural changes. European culture wasn't superior, it just had better tech at the time of first contact. I don't want any kind of noble, savage, over-romanticized version of colonized cultures. But as a simple example, why does Montezuma lose his ability to use defeated enemy soldiers as slaves after the ancient era? We don't do that now in our world because of specific cultural events. There's no reason that has to be true in a Civ game.
This is tough. I don't want to criticize this too hard because like some of what the poster is getting at, I agree with. On the other hand, it's also hard to separate some of these questions. Just for example, slavery as an institution has pretty nasty ramifications for any nation running it. Like, it does things to how your economy runs and whatnot. Like, beyond simply being unethical, it screws with your ability to innovate and improve over time. So not only is it unethical, it's a bad long-term proposition, too. So there's some merit to wanting to get out of it. So, like, should Montezuma lose it? Well, that depends. And it also depends, like, I mean, anybody could use slavery in principle, right? Like, we used it in Civ 4, and certainly most of our history is blighted with that crap. So, representing it as a specific thing to Montezuma is awkward, because it's not really a cultural phenomenon. It's kind of just a historical blight that had some utility to some people, but broadly made areas of the world worse overall. So should we check out of that? Probably. As opposed to like something where you invest more in aircraft versus naval versus whatever. I'd like to point out that, yes, British had an excellent navy at one point in time, but they were also the first people to roll out tanks. Not particularly good initially, but they were. That was a British invention with help of some other people from other countries. So, again, is this really a question of tech versus investment and in an economy model that's really more complex than Civ can handle that the scope Civ plays at? I don't know.
This is written by a space ostrich on YouTube.
It's the same thing with, well, I think maybe Chernobyl's the best example, because nuclear really would be, it would not solve all of our problems, but it would solve a significant number of the problems we're seeing today the short term.
Yeah, and between that and Three Mile Island here in the U.S., it scared the general public off the idea of it and made it seem more dangerous than it actually is.
That's kind of sad. Like, Chernobyl, you should be scared of another Chernobyl happening. Three Mile Island wasn't great. But like the amount of damage that did was nothing, basically. If you compare it to like the amount of suffering that other sources of power cause, it is nothing. You can have like 50 Chernobyls and it's not as bad as the coal mining we do. Like, it's a joke in terms of that. So yeah, I mean, if anything, our worst event being Chernobyl in the US should not have scared the public, but it did. Now, is that cultural though, or is that just how people are when it comes to new stuff?
And people took advantage. People who were anti-nuclear took advantage of both of those events to push that fear mongering, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Now I guess if we developed nuclear more strongly first, then our private interests would have had more influence on government regulation in the other direction. But yeah, I don't know that that's a cultural thing, as much as it's just an incentives thing. And again, like these are pretty complex things to model when you're rolling like, you know, 1 to 10 years in a friggin' turn.
Yeah.
But like, I get where they're coming from. It would be cool to have nations diverge a little bit in terms of like what technologies give them, or, you know, where they're strong versus weak based on their investments. I don't think that should be tethered to the Civ. Because like, who's to say that the Aztec, following a completely different historical trajectory, wouldn't have become like a completely enlightened civilization, right? You know, hundreds of years later, that's like, that has a better moral standard than we manage ourselves. We don't know. You know, a lot happens in hundreds of years. And I mean, enlightened from our perspective, even. It's just, there's too much that can happen in that time frame. And like saying that they couldn't have gone otherwise is nonsense. So I don't like tethering some of this stuff to cultures, because cultures adapt and evolve over time. And we also don't know what cultures would have looked like, you know, had they persisted.
I suppose that's one good point within millennia, with the way they take culture, where you can sort of roll your own culture as you go. I mean, it does kind of make whoever you pick to play more of a bit of a skin, but it gives you that option to diverge differently, to go along a different, at least, cultural development path. And it does have those alternate tech paths as well. We go through like the steampunk age and things like that.
I do like what we're getting here at here with the terrain influencing, because it does to an extent. Yeah, it influences how people live their daily lives, which is going to influence their culture to a degree. So like picking things that make sense for your region, which would then inform the culture that you're mimicking or whatever. I think that's something that Civ could implement in the future. It'd be quite reasonable to do.
They have, you know, with the start biases.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
There's that.
But I mean, like, more granular.
Yeah, because you've got Vietnam, who is linked to rainforest and stuff like that, and Inca linked to mountains. But even if you try to set up everything in the start, you don't always get an appropriate start that matches that civilization better. If you could choose these, some of these aspects afterwards, you could match your civilization to the start you got, you know.
Yeah, and I think you could still, you could do that and still, like, have things that were related to the civ.
That would require a different style of game, though, because the things that set the civs apart in these games is their natural abilities and their unique stuff. But if you're setting it up based on terrain...
That's true in Civ 6.
Well, even in Civ 5, they had an ability.
Sure, but not in Civ 4. And yet Civ 4 civs were still very distinct. Their unique units were based on historical stuff.
Yeah, we could still have the unique units. You could still have a unique building, but then maybe your aspects that are your reaction to the terrain that your civ starts in could be something that's separate. You know, while culturally some of these things would have been true, hey, if the Inca had evolved in a place that was a little bit lower on a flat plain, it would be different. It would still be the Inca. They might have some of their unique unit and things, but, you know, it would work a little bit differently. Sorry,
it would also be funny if you could, like, start as nothing and, like, you over time you become Inca or you become the United States or you become Germany.
Well, that's what, like, humankind
that's
does.
What millennia does, but I mean, like, more emphatically, like, you still get the unique units and everything like Civ, but you build into that directly. They could do it if they wanted. Now maybe they think that's too close to millennia for the next Civ game, but maybe not.
I think part of the problem is we're assuming that civilization is designed primarily as a historical resource rather than a game.
Well, sure, but this is a trade-off in game mechanics.
Yeah.
I'm not proposing something that's, like, out of balance for a game. It's just a different game, basically.
Yeah, which isn't Civ, and that's okay.
Well, that's not really true. Like, each of the civs have been pretty different from the previous in very significant ways. To say it's not really Civ, like, you know, Civ 4, 5, and 6 aren't really Civ then, considering how different they are from, like, Civ 1 and 2. Civ 1 and 2 didn't have anything unique about the civs other than their names. They didn't have any start biases or any of that stuff.
Yes, but back then, how different were the tiles?
Also much more limited.
Yeah.
But that's my point. Like, these games change and evolve over time. Ultimately, it's going to come down to what the devs think people are going to play and enjoy and what the devs want to make.
Should we move on?
Don't know if we answered the response, but we gave a lot of talk.
We certainly appreciate feedback, too.
Yes.
True.
So, and more of that, if willing.
So let's talk about the new challenge of the month from Firaxis. This is 3 stars each. You play as Babylon, and you have to win a science victory. And the civics and technology trees are shuffled and hidden for this event. Other than that, there's not much special about it. The map is randomized this time. And everyone you fight against is different this time, so it's not really a scenario. It's just, hey, win a science victory on quick speed as Hammurabi on a Pangaea map in a standard Civ game, basically. So
this sounds like the setup for Turncast.
Yeah, kind of.
Because it's quick speed. We've been using the tech and Civic Shuffle for a while. It's just the Civ's pre-selected here.
But you're Babylon, so you have to use Eureka's to actually make progress.
Which also requires me to remember what the heck the Eurekas are.
Yeah, and because the techs and civics are hidden, you have to, like, have a good memory and have played a lot. This is kind of...
This is play with a wiki open.
That would work, too.
Now, you don't win if you kill everyone, right? But you will eventually win space.
If you send a spaceship to space, you will win. If you kill everyone, you will not win until you send a ship to space.
Yeah, but who's going to stop you?
Well, if you don't build it.
Is the turn
I'm just saying, you can get more science with more cities.
I guess it doesn't say score victory, so I guess you would just play the game indefinitely until you went to space.
Yeah. Well, like, once you're steamrolling, I don't know how often you guys play, like, dominating games like that, but, like, once you're steamrolling, you're not backwards any longer, because you just have so much stuff.
Yeah.
So many trade routes, so many units, so many cities, and they're like, that translates to so many science districts if you wanted to.
Eventually, you'll build everything.
Yeah, you could conquer the map and leave one civ with one tiny city somewhere and then just, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what you would do if, like, you lose by conquering everyone. Then you would just leave, like, one capital besieged and with no tiles, and you just laugh at it because it can't do anything. And then you just, like, encircle it.
So while we're on the discussion of challenges, did anybody do the Ides of March after we talked about it last month?
I did not.
I did not either.
Had her a few weeks there.
There's also this thing with the moon going in front of the sun that distracted me.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, I did eventually win the Ides of March game. I killed all the AIs after completing the tech tree, actually, just because I was so far ahead of them. Even though they were on a team, they all were not very great. To be fair, it was Prince difficulty, but it was quite fun. There's not a whole lot of oil on the map, so if you get to the later eras or later parts of the game, you just kind of have to make sure you've conquered Gaul at least, because there's like 3 oil in Gaul. A lot of oil up by Britain, even though there's not really any cities there unless you settle. Aluminum is present, so you can get the jet bombers, which I have discovered after finally getting to the era with jet bombers, that jet bombers are very powerful, despite being very short-ranged.
I admit I've never used them much.
You know, if you're playing an early game aggressive, you don't really need to, because you're usually done by the time they come around.
Yeah, well, plus, like, you have so many well-promoted, like, unit armies that you can work with. But if you're not going nukes, you're just going to end the world with that. It's like, artillery armies with 5 range and every promotion are no joke. They will mulch stuff.
Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed by the way the AIs actually fought me. Because when I started the war, it was the modern era. Is there still a modern era in Civ 6? I don't know. It's industrial. Maybe. I think it's industrial. Does it go to industrial to modern?
I don't remember what they call themselves.
I think it is, because it was before the atomic era. But either way, they all kind of just sat there and didn't really fight back, except for Alexander. Some of them didn't even build units as I was killing them. That might be a Prince AI problem, but the real challenge with that game was just moving the units, because it was such a slog to fight first in France and then take out the city in Spain and then go all the way around the Fertile Crescent to Egypt.
Yeah.
I did actually start it and get into it, so I saw some of the stuff on the map, but I kept getting frustrated with the AI was doing what you would normally do to take out the barbarian camps. It was like, excuse me, I need those.
The trick for that is to just put one of your units on top of it.
Yeah, I figured out later to just park a legion up there, and then that could stop. It's just that early on that happened with a couple of ones, and then there's that one, what is it, Mediolanum.
Mediolanum.
It's off to the east. Yeah, yeah, they kept flipping. Constantly flips. Even if you built other cities around it, too, it kept flipping. It, like, it was set to permanently be unhappy. And it's like, but why?
Well, because
I could stabilize.
It's right next to Alexander's capital. And his capital has high population.
But even after I built a couple of cities around it for, like, you know, cultural support, and even got the city to the east of it on the Black Sea stabilized, but it was still flipping. I was like, I have to sit here and keep units parked here to keep taking the city back and taking the city back and taking the city back. It's like it would never acknowledge any other pressure, that counter pressure I put.
What I did was I just let it fall and gave it basically to Greece, and then just conquered it later.
Yeah, I've never found counter pressure to be too helpful, as opposed to just, like, taking the things that are causing the pressure.
The real problem with Alexander, I guess he's Macedonian, isn't he? His capital is sandwiched between mountains, so there's, like, two tiles you can attack it from. Which makes early game capturing pretty difficult.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the balloons that allow you to actually shoot over things yet.
You would need a significant tech advantage, because then you can battering ram the walls down and it can't shoot at you anymore. And then you can like cycle units until you wear out itself. That's going to be miserable if he's an archer in it. But if he's something other than an archer in it, it won't be too bad.
Yeah, I got too frustrated, so I didn't come back to it, and then Eclipse happened, so.
Yeah. Actually, I think the challenge was over on the day of the Eclipse.
Yeah, I think it was the very last day, and the new thing, new challenge rolled in the next morning.
I'm going to try 3 stars each. I have not actually won a game as Babylon yet, so I do need to do that at some point. It just seems like this one feels really disappointing compared to the other ones. Because the robot one was really unique, and the other ones at least had a gimmick with them. This one is just win science victory with tech and civic shuffle.
Well, and yeah. A civ that strongly depends on the
Eurekas, yeah.
On the Eurekas. I don't think that's that bad. Like, okay, it's not as like wonky as GDRs is all over the place. But like it'll help people get used to the Eurekas, and it's certainly a different way to play than just like a standard settings game.
The reason I am disappointed by it is because everything else is randomized. Like the map and the civilizations are randomized. So it's not really a challenge map. It's just,
that's true.
That's the real disappointing part.
Yeah, it would have been
cooler
if this was on like a fixed map. That's true.
That's the problem I have with it. Because all the others have been on fixed maps.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the things that makes these kinds of games more interesting, is that everyone is playing a similar experience. That way you can compare outcomes.
Yeah, but with the random maps, there's going to be so many things. Like, even just your resources are going to be laid out differently, so everyone's going to have a different...
Yeah.
You know, this is what some of the people in the Civ Fanatics thread are disappointed about, because it's just like more like a basic random game and not what they have been previously, which is closer to the Hall of Fame type challenges, just on scenarios.
Yeah, or the other like games of the month, like we used to do the Nobles Club, and then higher level copies of the same thing, basically.
Yeah, you can tell how the Civ Fanatics community feels about it if you go to the general discussion Civ 6 forum and you see April challenge thread, nine replies. Compared to, admittedly, this is a different time span, but if you go to the one where it's Head of Cyrus, there's 49 posts, and
Yeah.
I can't find the one for Ides of Mars. Well, actually, it's right underneath it, because I'm blind as a bat. Never develop mind rot, folks. It's awful.
I do my best. I think time makes that pretty difficult eventually, though.
Well, that's not what I'm talking about, but yes.
Ultimately.
Don't get sick with things that you can't cure.
Yeah, don't get sick, don't get old. Don't get anything negative. Just get good things. Just get good.
We have...
If only.
We have a few more news topics.
All right. Well, I guess we're going to talk about Neuralink a little bit. I didn't realize the tech was this advanced, but apparently we have it available now. And one of the first things someone did with Neuralink was play chess in Civ. So very impressive.
And he stayed up. He said it stayed up all night to play Civ.
Yeah, typical.
Yeah, I mean, that's not that unusual. And especially if, like, you can finally do it after you couldn't do it previously.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
at the bottom of the one, or in the middle of one of the articles, it says thanks to the implant, he's also been able to play Civilization 6 outside of Neuralink research sessions. This recently resulted in an 8-hour gaming session until his implant needed to be recharged wirelessly. So basically, he ran his batteries down playing Civ.
The only thing that can stop one more turn.
Yeah, I'm running out of power would do that.
Like, so this is Elon Musk's company, and he's controversial nowadays. It is kind of scary to be talking about things like this, at least to me, who's a dedicated Luddite, but it's true. But, you know, if you're going to be doing something with putting things, implants in people's brains. It's a good thing that they're doing it on people who actually need it rather than just people who want it.
Oh, that makes the most sense from a technological progression standpoint. Like, this stuff isn't cheap, at least not yet. And, like, there's some obvious risks with doing it.
Yeah.
But if you have no alternative, then it's a good thing to try if the person in question wants to try it. So, yeah, I mean, of course it's going to start here. But I don't know, like, if this is significantly different from, like, a prosthetic limb, I don't know that it's conceptually so. It's just that it's much more challenging from a technological standpoint to do it. Because ultimately, like, you're still having your brain choose what happens. This is just a more direct connection.
Yeah.
And the third does go on to mention that they're also looking into shunt signals so that you can, like, restore the ability to move to paraplegic and quadriplegic people. Now, that would be incredible. Like, that's an amazing technology if they can get it going. Even what we're reading in this thread is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the starter ways to get into. You've watched so many things with the cyberpunk type things that have all those different implants and Deus Ex. Think of all the amount of implants and stuff that's in that. This is like the very beginning of that kind of technology. It's going to advance further, you know, and just even in the simple uses of being able to get people to walk again who have lost limbs or something like that and have a better replacement limb than they currently have.
Yeah.
You know, that, or even for people who are paraplegic or quadriplegic, being able to get use of their body back would be amazing. It's just with, like, anything with new technology, we have to be cautious as we go because we don't know all of the ramifications and all of what the complications are going to be as it progresses.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. Although, I mean, we have some idea of with foreign bodies and implanted and stuff. Like, we have some experience with that already, and we know it's not trivial.
Yes.
So be careful with that. But yeah, there's going to be things we haven't considered as well.
It makes me hopeful but cautious at the same time, you know.
I don't want to end up in a cyberpunk future. I don't think we're going to, but I just don't want to be there.
I mean, like, we have stuff today that was
to the internet.
Like a lot of the stuff we're doing, including the method we're using to record the show, would have been considered sci-fi stuff, like, you know, 30 years ago.
Talk to people in different countries instantaneously.
Yeah, like over the internet. Yeah, with nothing extra charged beyond just your internet connection. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would have been ridiculous as a concept in the 1990, like at 1990 or something, or, you know, early 90s. The internet barely existed, and it's a commercial tool then. But hey, now we have it. And we don't have the same dystopian future that our sci-fi stories had. We have a different dystopian future, and that's probably going to be true for this tech as well.
I don't believe in dystopias.
I mean, it's all relative. Yeah, I mean, certainly the advent of the internet and the communication across it has had some negative ramifications for people in various ways, especially like young people like living on social media and getting all kinds of comparative feedback. We're seeing some pretty low quality of life metrics in some ways for both men and women who are, well, I guess they're kids, so that's something you have to deal with. And certainly, I think a lot of the polarization we've observed in recent years has emerged from that technology. But, like, the internet has been so valuable in so many ways. You can't just, like, no, we're not going to use it. That's not a competitive choice. So you just have to, like, figure out how you deal with the technology so it's as minimally harmful as possible while giving you tons of benefits. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, expanded so fast and got usable by so many people. And we didn't necessarily train up the generations after to know how to filter things or know how to handle it better.
We didn't know.
Yeah, in a sense, but there's other things. It's like this going backwards. Like our parents telling us to not trust things on the internet. Now they're the ones we're having to tell them, no, not everything you see is a miracle cure. They're just trying to sell you a supplement. Would you stop buying these things?
Yeah, that's true.
There needed to be classes in like media awareness or something like that. And it hasn't happened. And it's probably still not going to happen. And you just have to hope that parents can raise their kids right. And well, oh boy, it's a mess.
I think part of the problem is we just did not have enough people with sufficient knowledge to teach that effectively.
And some of those
technology
people
advanced too quickly.
We also don't have enough people that know enough about it. They were making the laws about it. That really helps too.
Yeah, it's been a problem for sure. Because then the people with interests in it can certainly influence how the laws get passed, and that results in some questionable outcomes. Yeah, yeah. Although that's nothing new. We've seen that throughout U.S. history.
With all sorts of history. Technologies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
It's not just here.
It's not just here. History.
That's true, too. But if you go, like, if you go back past information era, the amount that they could do it is less, just as a consequence of how communication worked. The interests were more like nobility or whatever. Like, the institutions that were influencing the ruling class were different. But you still had it, for sure. You're right.
I would argue that not qualitatively different, but, you know.
Yeah, maybe not. Just the incentives in question for everyone are a little different, yeah.
Depends who it was, depends where it was.
Yeah, but maybe you're right that qualitatively it isn't so.
If you had money, you could do it, no matter who you were, or what you were doing, or what your organization was.
Yeah, to some degree. So yeah, this is cool stuff, for sure.
Yes. And one last news thing. There's two new things. Well, I'm going to do this one. But
yep.
Yeah. 2K bought Paradox and Millennia is the next Civ game to villain. Oh, no, wait. That's April Fools. Which, they did well because it's just almost believable enough that it actually caught a few people in different Discords that I've seen a little bit unaware. Then everybody went, wait, what's today?
Yeah. the best part was. The pages are no longer up, but Kotaku, PC Gamer, and IGN reported on it.
So, yeah, I don't know if they got some cooperation with that, or they were all just doing the scrambling to report and then not realizing what day it was.
I missed this when it happened, but this would be a very interesting merger were it to happen, to put it mildly.
Yeah, it's like, if you want to approve of their all the DLCs all the time, all much DLC, very WoW model.
I don't think Firaxis would stop that. if anything, if they're going to buy them, they'd keep the gravy train rolling.
At least one article mentioned the highest priority DLC for Millennia as Civ 7 was customizable GDR skin, and they would be especially noteworthy on Millennia's combat screen.
Yeah, of course. And don't forget armor for your cavalry units.
This would allow further alternative choices, including the generation of an actually flat Earth.
That one with the armor for the cavalry units, that only just got me. I was like, wait, and now I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Horse armor DLC!
You can generate flat Earth originally. For Axis games. You just turn off world wrap, and it's flat. I mean, that's more or less what you're doing.
Yeah. That's it. The projection of the map itself is already flat, so that's all you have to do. Turn off world wrap. It's square. Or rectangle, sorry.
The devs, turtles all the way down in that world.
The devs hope that an in-world flat Earth will finally satisfy people who have been critical of the grid-based movement, which does not scale well with latitude on a globe, but does not cause issues on a flat Earth.
Hey.
I like it.
And we have... okay, well done with your posts, guys. Yes. We love it. Keep doing this. I know you're going to, but this was a good one. It's almost as good as Ultimate Civilization Rumble from several years back.
Because everybody was like...
Because it would have been a great game if we could just play... if it was just a fighting game with all the world leaders of history.
It could have just been a Flash fighting game or something they could have put out on the day of. That would have been, you know...
Well, if it was Flash, it'd be gone now, so... Well,
that's true. You but, get what I mean, though.
Yes,
it would have been... I still use the Uncle Slam attack.
Yeah.
My nephews greatly appreciated.
I'm sure they did. Why are my ribs broken?
Now, I only need one kid in the head once.
Jeez.
That kid was crazy. I mean, it's been, like, probably 10 years now. Maybe not quite. That kid was... He had, like, no regard. Like, he lunged at me while I was, like, wrestling, like, multiple kids. Got kneed in the head. And, like, as I'm going to check if he's okay, he, like, used that opportunity to dive at me again and grab my leg. I'm like, okay, this kid's not normal. Like, he did that all the time, though, even with the other kids. Like, he would actively disregard things that would, like, make everyone else cry and just keep going. Like, he had something unusual with sensing pain. He did not care. I was genuinely impressed. Like, that would have given people, like, who were actually in high school, like, sports pause. And he just disregarded it like it didn't happen, like, immediately. It was so unusual. Like, until you, like, see somebody operate that way, like, it's hard to describe it without observing it. But yeah, he didn't care about pain. I still felt bad, though.
Yikes. Let's talk about Millennia. So, it came out right after our last episode, and, I haven't played it, but a bunch of our other game group friends played it, and they were talking about how it was a great game, and then they stopped playing it, and they haven't played it since.
Well, a lot of them have gone to, like, Helldivers and stuff. They play a wide variety of things all the time. So
happened with the content creator people, too. Everybody was all on it that first week or two, and I haven't seen any new games of it picked up.
I mean, it doesn't help. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it feels like the first two or three or four games through, you have a lot of fun, you do a lot of different things, but then certain things get repetitive and annoying. Not that that doesn't happen in Civ, mind you, but it's a different kind. If all of them have put it to the side and are playing everything else, that kind of tells me something.
So we have a really good first impressions report from Lord Lakely on Civ Fanatics, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because it is a very comprehensive write-up, but it's very critical. Turns out, the things we were worried about are pretty severe. The game punishes you extremely harshly for playing a peaceful builder game. If any of the other civs get stronger than you, they will declare war and will not make peace until you either defeat them or have somehow made it so they don't think they can beat you. Also, the game doesn't tell you any of the mechanics that help with the special stuff, like... he talks about theologians and monasteries, which are only allowed on hills. After unlocking monasteries, it doesn't show you in the Infopedia. It doesn't tell you what you do. You don't know how to build monasteries, and it gives you no hints. What you actually have to do is research organized religion first, and you can only build monasteries in outposts attached to a city, not in actual cities. The game doesn't tell you any of this. Other problems... that happen are
Age of Plague Crisis area for everybody, because somebody on the other continent is doing it all wrong, but it plunges the entire world into it, and you haven't even met them yet. That makes no sense.
And even if you are taking care of your cleanliness properly or hygiene requirement, it still hits you, and you still have to clean up your whole empire. And let's not even talk about the fact that any city you found that isn't your homeland is like a second-class city that doesn't really do as much as the rest of the stuff as your capital does. And, that's not how a game like this you're supposed to play.
Well, now wait, if somebody conquers another nation and that results in a power advantage, doesn't that mean that the secondary cities are doing something?
They give you mana points.
Because otherwise you wouldn't have that kind of advantage.
I don't actually know how the mechanics of fighting work. All I know is they are...
I'm just saying that those two criticisms sound inconsistent to each other. Like, if conquering somebody is so beneficial that it's an alpha strategy that you have to do, the stuff you're conquering can't be that weak. It has to... Like, one or the other must be the more relevant consideration.
It says here that... directly consoling cities almost always leads to problems, even if you micro them, so you're always better off playing like Civ 5 Venice. The playstyle causes you to fall behind the AI, which, as you only have one or maybe two cities to get all the value types of experience from, or units, it gets very difficult to get both. No matter how well you build up your industry, you will always come up short militarily and economically unless you choose to integrate more cities in your empire, and doing that destabilizes your empire. Walking this tightrope could work if values were properly balanced, but they're not. Vassalization is a broken mechanic that solves all your problems. Unrest, vassalize. City creates a crisis, vassalize. Vassalize, vassalize. Oh, absorb the city, dev it, then vassalize it again, rinse and repeat. It gets old very quickly.
This sounds like some of the Civ 5 teething issues.
Yeah, this is directly from the report here.
Yeah, but like I'm hearing that and I'm remembering some criticisms of puppeting cities in Civ 5 or whatever the hell it was called, like because of the happiness cap, you would wind up doing something very similar if you're mass conquering. So you wouldn't like absolutely trash your science progress, but you still get something out of the cities.
There's also some event that some other civ can do that can cause rebels to appear on every tile of your civilization.
This must be one of the other crisis event type things.
I think it
sounds like one.
I think it's an event, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, this is a typical paradox in that it's poorly documented.
Yeah, and there was a whole other thing I've seen from other games about it's not that event with the raiders, but it's something else that you can start when your own civ, and you also can get like rebels, constant rebel thing, and it's hard to quash, and then it helps you spiral into more crises, which doesn't help.
His conclusion is, I just feel like this game failed at the overall objective of playing a game in the first place, which is to have fun. Sure, my fun is not your fun. If you enjoy painfully realistic simulators of how the Western Roman Empire fell, then this game is absolutely for you.
Yeah, there's at least a couple of people I was watching that stuck to just a few cities, especially towards the end game, because trying to manage the empire was impossible. You get to the civ level of domination victory size of empires, like you've got your whole continent, but trying to manage that many cities is just a headache.
Yeah, because they don't know how to make a UI, basically. But we knew that from other Paradox games. However, like I don't know that the concept of the game is bad if you actually balance the trade-offs and it's not a chore to play. But like even Civ 6, for its improvements over Civ 5 and UI, is still like way behind decent as an implementation when it comes to UI. Like, it's frustrating that these otherwise good games are such a slog to play through just because the basics of inputting commands to the game are like in some ways inferior to 1990s games. And in other ways, they just like don't implement things that have been functional and good for other games for years. Yeah, I don't know. Like that's been a pet peeve of mine for over a decade now. So I'm not saying anything new here, but it is a shame that I guess people who make turn-based strategy games just can't find a single person capable of implementing a good UI.
And sometimes they do it differently just so they can say they're different from X game. That's not just a strategy game problem either.
They've gotten a little better with like displaying information that's pertinent for Axis Has. I wouldn't say that Paradox has gotten better with that. In some cases, like Tinto did pretty good with E4 lately, in terms of making the user interface present information accurately and making it more possible to see what you need to do at a glance. There's so much crap going on in EU4 that it's hard. But they have noticeably improved that over the last 2 years, say. But my gosh, the other Paradox games are awful. Like Hearts of Iron 4, I think there's some unethical things with how they represent information. It's so bad. Like they straight up like lie to you about achievement requirements, and like you bug report that, and they still straight up lie to you about the achievement requirements years later. So like you'll lose hours if you try for them because they don't tell you the truth. I think that there's some legitimately ethical criticisms there. That's not just bad. That's like really bad. So yeah, I'm not gonna like, and this is similar in that you can't see what the rules of the game are using the game, and that's awful. It's just awful. But input efficiency is another aspect of user interface. Like I think input efficiency versus clear presentation of the game information are both UI, but they're different. They're distinct from each other. And in terms of input efficiency, all of these games are bad. It's unbelievable. Like Civ has regressed since 4 in input efficiency, and Paradox never had it. They added a little bit in EU4. Again, that's why I'm praising Tinto. They've actually taken steps to make it take less thousands of clicks to get through a game than previously. That's impressive. More of that, please. We're nowhere near. But I appreciate some effort in that regard, simply because we just don't see that out of modern Civ games, out of Paradox games. I don't know that I've played a turn-based strategy in recent memory that took any measures to make your inputs more efficient. So I appreciate when I observe the effort.
Part of the cloud of ideas that we now call user experience.
Yeah, UX.
UI UX, basically.
Yeah, Civ has like you can enable the stuff that like shows you everyone's research rate and some information about them and whatnot, and that's good. That's a good UI aspect. It's just insufficient when you're like having inconsistent input buffering and you need to do like hundreds of extra unnecessary clicks to manage your cities and units per turn if you have a really big nation. That if the UI were better, you would not have to do that. That's still frustrating to me, because it should not be as hard as the design elements that the game gets right. In principle, it shouldn't be. But based on what we observe, maybe it is, because like pretty much no one's doing it.
I don't have any direct insight onto that problem, because I know they talk about UI UX, but it doesn't seem like they understand. I don't know.
Yeah, I just think it should be possible to manage like a 20 city empire crudely in like, 30 seconds to a minute. But that's just not how it is in Civ 6. You don't have the options to do inputs that way.
And there's a lot of other people are saying in here, what's diplomacy? Because, oh boy.
The AI declares on you and hates you no matter what you do. They will declare on you if they think they can kill you immediately, and they will not stop trying to kill you until you can build up enough units to show that they're not strong enough to kill you, which is difficult to do. I don't remember exactly why they said that was difficult to do.
I do think having some aggro in the AI is good, because especially because, like, first of all, you want competition over land and resources in your game, because that, mm-hmm. that gives you incentive to do things. And two, like, if that's beneficial, the AI should do it.
Yes.
On the other hand, there should be some evaluation going on there, so it's like not the only thing to do, or if it is objectively the only way to play the game, then maybe you should look at that, because it doesn't seem like that was the intention, is to make the only one approach consistently the best option when you have other options you can pick from. Ideally, if you have a bunch of options you could pick from, there should be some situations in which you would pick all of them. Maybe some are less common than the others, but like you're making decisions based on what you observe rather than just like always picking one thing out of all these options, ideally.
The general opinion in the thread, and this goes over two pages, and it's at the time that I looked at this section, which is the Millennia section in the Paradox Games forum, there were maybe one or two posts that weren't Paradox Dev Diaries in the whole forum. But it was like nowadays there are more, which is ironically half of them are news releases from the website itself, from Firaxis itself and their staff, talking about things that are happening. But
yeah, it's disappointing for that Millennia didn't do more with diplomacy. Paradox is a very mixed bag with diplomacy. It basically does not exist in Hearts of Iron. However, I think EU4's implementation of diplomacy is stronger than any iteration of Civ ever, and by a margin.
I would agree, because
so like they have it in them potentially.
Like civilization,
CK has been pretty good too.
Civilization has always been bad at diplomacy. I can't remember a Civ game that was good at diplomacy. Except
in EU4, you have incentive structures that align to using diplomacy effectively.
Like in
EU4, if you want, you can sit in an alliance with somebody from the start of the game to the end of the game, and there's a trust mechanic so that if you have trust high enough, the AI will not like willingly break the alliance with you unless you like really piss it off, or like you have to conquer like 2/3 of Europe and they're in Europe so they care, and they have that much aggressive expansion that even with the reduction for alliance, like they hate you, they go negative opinion. Like otherwise, if you have 80 plus trust with an AI, you can sit with that AI in an alliance for like hundreds of years and they will not rival you. They will not break the alliance. They will not like, you either have to like piss them off or you have to like take gold that they really want and be like a tiny weakling. If you don't do one of those two things, you have them forever. But there's also like planning around how you keep your own alliances so your enemies don't break them through peace deals. And you can also like ally your enemy's allies and drag that ally into a war and attack your enemy. And now they can't join you against you because they're in a war with you. There's a lot of like really nuanced interactions that arises as a result of the system, and a lot of long range planning that's required to expand optimally that involves diplomacy. And the AI will like work with other AI much less effectively than the human, but still in a way that can threaten you if you screw up. Like you can have an AI bring in like four other nations to attack you. And if you're not accounting for that possibility, you're screwed.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in that system that's excellent. So it's a pretty big disappointment that Millennia is just basically like Hearts of Iron. Ugh.
let me compare the diplomatic options you have in EU4 to the ones in Civ 6. In Civ 6, all of your diplomatic options fit on one screen. Basically, you don't have to scroll to see them unless you open a submenu. In EU4, you have 8 categories, and if you open them all, it takes 3 or 4 menu lengths worth of space to fill to see all of them. There are so many diplomatic options.
Yeah.
And they all pretty much do something that is effective in some way. Some of them you don't use very often because they're niche, but they all do something effective. Like, they will all do something.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's probably the strongest diplomatic game that I've played.
I actually think the diplomacy in the Civ series is best in Beyond Earth, surprisingly. But it's still not good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's somewhat tight between Beyond Earth and 5 for the ideologies, but it's still limited.
Beyond Earth is a lot better because they have the respect and whatever the other one was, the system that had 2 different things that showed how much they feared you and how much they liked you and how those interacted affected things. And
they didn't inform decisions that often, though, in my experience playing Beyond Earth. Maybe that's different for other people.
Did you play single player much?
Not that much. Let me see what my hours are at.
Well, I know we played a lot of multiplayer, but in single player, it matters a lot more.
Well, I did play single player, though. Like, I would screw the AI on the highest difficulty. None. Oh, right. It starts with S.
Yeah. Sid Meier's.
Only 63 hours, so I didn't play it that long.
I don't think anybody did.
I say that, but that, like, that's, like, not that much less than my runs in Hollow Knight, so I don't know.
Completely different games, though.
Yeah, but it is kind of funny to say that, like, oh yeah, this is like 2 full work weeks. Although 60 isn't, but like I'm looking at Hollow Knight now, and that's like right around 80. Like, yeah, 2 weeks of time isn't that much. 2 full work weeks, it's not that much time to play a game. Like, okay.
Out of the 8 years it's been released, that's not bad at all.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I guess it just depends what you're expecting when you pick a game up.
Now,
you can certainly play there them way more than that.
Your EU4 hours might be a bit much.
Jesus. Yeah. Yeah, I'm over 9K now. Some percentage of that is AFK time, but less than I would care to say. But I probably am only in the upper 8Ks if you factor like time where I like leave the game on and walk away for a bit.
Yeah. The upshot of the Millennia games incompleteness and poorness is they announced on release day or before release day 2 DLCs that are coming later this year. They're both $25 each.
I'm sure they'll fix all the problems.
One of them is specifically to add nuclear weapons and stuff like that, which don't exist in the game from the start, which why?
It's tradition. If you're playing this kind of game, you have to be able to nuke people.
Like, I don't understand why the most iconic weapon of the 20th century was not added to a game about history. Especially a game where they invented their own weapon that was more powerful and more destructive in that orbiting satellite thing, the Archangel. Which is basically just, if you put enough of these in orbit, you win because nobody can fight back. And the game recognizes this and just gives you the Archangel victory condition. But
Hammer of Dawn.
But no, we can't have nukes because why exactly?
Well, it would conflict with this new satellite.
Well, this satellite is later tech. But this is also a game where you can contact aliens.
Nukes tend to end games in terms of like they let the player win if the player has them.
I've spent how many hours in this game and I'm really frustrated. I just want to nuke some things.
Like any time in any game I've played that has nukes, once you can deploy them, if you do, you will tend to just win.
Well,
I'm not sure that's even an accurate representation of nukes as a historical tool, in terms of like when they were first implemented, because like when they're still dropping them out of planes, they were really threatening, but they were not like an instant win button in like Civ games, though. Or people don't say it, but like even once you have a pool of nukes available in Hearts of Iron, like even then it's like you can't fight anymore. The only way to defend that is air superiority, and if you don't have it, then you just get your entire army like destroyed basically. And this probably would be true in Millennia as well. Like once you start nuking that crap out of somebody, you don't have to worry about Archangels or any other later game tech, because they're just not going to be able to do anything.
Yes, I agree with this in concept, but what I'm saying is they should be in the game because it is a thing that is very iconic in the 20th century and still a big deal now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're going to include things like tanks or planes or whatever, yeah, you might as well include nukes too. Yeah.
If you're going to invent a kinetic energy satellite that just throws things into the ground, which does much more damage than a nuke could ever do, why don't we have nukes as well? And the obvious answer is because they wanted a $25 nuclear age DLC.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's how their model works. But and I would have less issue with the model if the games were more functional slash better. And if they weren't asking $25 for that.
Like, as it turns out, a base of DLC modeling system where it's like, okay, you buy a $20 expansion pack once a year. That can work, and it's not terrible. As long as the game has solid enough mechanics that it can stand on its own at launch.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true for any game. It needs to be a good game first, or none of the surrounding monetization attempts are going to be useful.
But Paradox doesn't
people still need to want to play it, or they're not going to pay for anything in it.
Like, Paradox doesn't seem to understand that.
Or they do, they just don't have the people to make good games across the board.
Well, with Hearts of Iron, they could assign more than 13 people to it.
Yeah, or they could have the 13 people on it and act more ethically. Yeah, that's true.
Like, for Victoria 3, they could fire the director and be like, you made a bad game, let's try to fix it. Like they did with EU4 when they fired the same guy.
But I don't think they have, like, enough people in-house to, like, make all these games better at once.
Maybe not, but I'm sure they have enough money that if they wanted to, they could.
Yeah, it's easy to say, but it's harder to find, like, people who are actually going to do the job significantly better, especially if you're just like interviewing someone and you just see a body of work. Like, a lot goes into that. I understand that it's hard to do.
There have been a lot of
layoffs
lately.
That's why I'm a little less critical of some things than others, but like I cannot stand that it, like, issues that cause major player inconveniences or worse and could be fixed by text editing what the display says so that that information is accurate just get ignored for like 4 years. That I can't stand. That really irks me.
Well, we know that
if you can't be good, at least be honest. Jesus.
We know that tons and tons of game makers and designers and such have been laid off in the last year. Surely Paradox could sift through that and find a single person who would be happy to live in Sweden and do a better job than Wiz.
They've tried it, and I'm sure they'll try it again.
I mean,
it's not like they haven't brought in new people.
Just from the Civ community, we've seen tons of people come out of it that are actual game developers now that are all really good at their jobs.
Yeah, like the lead dev of Civ 5.
He's like the only one that did a bad job, though. Because if you look into who actually works at some of these people, a lot of them are former Civ people. Like, Solver now works with Mohawk Games, with those people. And he was an old Civ guy.
Yeah.
So I can't believe that they can't find people who do a better job. Like, even the people who make Anbanar, hire them!
It's true. Some of the mod devs in these Paradox games have been significantly better than the base game devs. And I don't just mean in terms of, like, the content design, but even the implementation. Like, they are more mechanically sound. Like, the product they produced is, A, better balanced, there's more depth to their focus / mission trees, and C, their interactions they create break the game probably an order of magnitude less frequently in some cases.
I'd say several orders of magnitude.
I would say at least one order of magnitude, because like if I'm comparing like Old World Blues or Equestria at War to base game Hearts of Iron,
The focus trees in those probably break less than a tenth as frequently because they adhere to some design principles that make it way less likely for their focus trees to break the friggin' game. And this despite that they're doing more complex things. But they just avoid a few pitfalls that they've realized break the game. And you reliably observe that they just don't do certain things with focuses. And yet Paradox still does in their paid DLC. So you have an outcome where, like, a random brony is just way better than the Paradox devs who are asking you to pay, like, $20 for a DLC. And it's like, oh my god.
We are not kidding. The Equestria at War, which is the Friendship is Magic My Little Pony mod, despite the fact that it's about ponies and unicorns and griffins, is still the best.
I hate that this is the best vanilla Hearts of Iron experience.
It's still the best.
I hate it.
It is
the
best.
That's the case.
There's no question it is the best one. It is the best designed. It is the most fun. And it's the most functional.
But I don't like what it shows I'm playing on Steam.
You're just a secret brony at heart.
I mean, I think we're past
at this rate, Jesus.
I think we're past the point now where bronyism is the toxic thing that it was at the time when it was popular to call people bronies.
It still has some questionable associations, though.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah.
But
like, what can you do? Like, and Old World Blues is based on the Fallout New Vegas universe, and I would say that's comparably good. But it is, in contrast to the other one, it is a total conversion mod. So you're not getting a very vanilla experience there. Like the divisions are different, the techs are different. You have like different tech caps for different types of people. Like the economy system is completely different. It's a good game. It is an excellent mod. And the fact that they did such a total conversion and it's more stable than the Hearts of Iron base vanilla is an incredible testament to what's possible if you have good designers working on it. However, it is certainly not vanilla. The other one uses vanilla text, but Old World Blues is a very different can of worms. But yeah, like I would say that the people who are most responsible for that are probably better than any of the focus tree designers for Hearts of Iron 4.
So yeah,
these people are really good.
Real quick, let's talk about the latest Hearts of Iron 4 DLC. What did it contain?
Just South American mission trees. Nothing.
Not
else.
Just South American mission trees. Only three major mission trees for three South American countries, and then one shared one for two smaller ones. And yet there are still, I don't know, most of South American countries that don't have focus trees, despite this being a DLC for $25 that is supposed to focus on South America. And it only focuses on Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, which admittedly are probably the biggest players in South America, but the heck happened to Peru and Bolivia and Ecuador and Venezuela and all those other countries that definitely had things going on at this time and definitely could be fleshed out? But nope, we got to charge you $25 for three mission trees and two countries that have a shared mission tree. And there's no like any new, there's no new mechanics. There's no new anything. There's just art and mission trees.
I think that's why it was so widely hit with negative reviews.
It's
a combination
it.
Of just they're not adding a whole lot. There's no new mechanics. And yeah,
literally
what
no
they
new
did
mechanics.
Add, again, like these are not competitive trees with what we're seeing in mods.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Like across the board, not competitive. Like not only is it not in depth, but again, they tend to break the game more. If you don't play the game, it's hard for me to explain what I mean by breaking the game. But I mean, interactions that the game doesn't warn you about that effectively end the run for one reason or another. Like either you're locked out of being able to complete an achievement because you can't do a certain focus, or due to an interaction between a couple focuses of different nations, the game state changes in a way that it takes more time to complete the run than it would just starting over. Like you can have things like normally you're not allowed to switch factions in the middle of a war, but due to a certain focus in China, a particular Chinese nation can. So like you can have the Chinese Communist Party in a tiny little like one state thing because they have not even fought their civil war in China yet. Switch from the Chinese United Front fighting against Japan in the middle of the war against Japan, and then they like switch to the Allies and then call the Allies in on a third party. So you can have like the Chinese Communist Party initiate the entire world dogpiling like Venezuela or something on allegedly historical focuses. It's just the degree of absurdity that some of these interactions cause is wild.
And this doesn't happen just once in a while with one country. It happens frequently with multiple countries.
Yeah.
This
happens with various focus trees. And if you're playing the game in like ways that are relatively challenging achievements or something, you can expect it probably in one half to one third run, something like that. It's a lot. It's very heavy.
Even if you're just playing a basic game, weirdness will happen. Even if you're not trying something difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a historical game just recently where I was playing as Brazil. I joined the Allies, fought the Axis, and then by like 1946, somehow China had managed to annex the parts of Germany I didn't take, and they were in the Allies for some reason, you know, with historical focuses set.
And
that actually did have ramifications for my run.
Yeah, because then they attacked Iran, which was your puppet.
Yeah, well, China didn't, but... The fact that that territory was held by China, and China was a member of the Allies somehow, even though they were a faction leader themselves, those two things combined made that scenario like borderline unwinnable. I probably could, but again, it would take me into like the late 1950s to fight that alliance, in which case I might as well just start over and kill the Allies right away.
I think
we're getting a little into the weeds, but my point is like there are aspects of this design that have serious negative ramifications for the game. And mod devs are way better at preventing this than the vanilla devs who are asking you to pay money for it. So yeah, maybe they should hire some of these people. Because these people are clearly better at the job than the Paradox devs are. Across the board. Not just like coming up with like neat content ideas, but because some of what Old World Blues does is really entertaining. But no, it's just mechanically, they're better implementations as well.
I just realized that Paradox is in Sweden, which I knew it was in Sweden, but I just remembered that. Based on what I know of European business regulation, maybe they literally can't afford to hire a single person because their taxes and their requirements are so onerous.
Maybe that's why they're putting some of their studios in other countries now.
I would not be surprised.
Because Tinto is in Spain.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there are Paradox.
Business laws are Paradox a lot. France. They're a lot more lax in Spain than they are in Sweden.
Yeah, well, that's probably why we're observing it.
For reference, if I were starting a business, I would not start it in any European country, simply because kind of don't want to have to deal with all of their regulations that are completely irrelevant to what I would need to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's easy to say as an American. If you're living in Europe and you want to operate with first a European market, then you probably do want to pick somewhere in Europe. Like, it's all about trade-offs, ultimately. So, yeah. And maybe some countries would be better for whatever you're trying to set up as a business than others. But yeah, being within the umbrella there might be more useful, even with some of the regulations that you'd have to deal with.
I'll be honest, I just don't want to pay a 20% value-added tax for everything I buy ever.
You're paying some percentage of that no matter where you are in the world, for one reason or another.
Well, sure, but it's complicated. It's not really a topic for a Civ podcast.
Yeah, we've deviated a little bit from our topics list here.
Bit of a tangent.
More tangents.
Although a lot of this Paradox stuff is relevant, more so than usual, because we were discussing Millennia, and a lot of the Paradox problems that are factors in other games are relevant to Millennia and vice versa. Okay, is it time for us to get out of the water, as Mackie says?
Well, we've been going for 100 and, well, not 100. Brain, I'm tired of you. Stop being
pool
stupid.
Water, cavalry armor, whatever, Mackie. It's all the same.
Well, at least okay, we got then to go after Shigarath.
Indeed. Well, thank you for joining us on Polycast episode 432. I've been the me and team as usual, not changing that up, and was joined by Canis Albinus.
Oh, I should have a witty retort here, but I don't.
Whee! And Makalua.
This is the occasional Millennia cast, along with Civ stuff.
I don't think we're going to be coming back to it, honestly.
No. The Civ and Civ Lite cast?
Well, it's okay. Well, it's okay for it to be Civ Lite stuff, because there's nothing else to talk about with Civ specifically right now, but kind of want to talk about good games.
Now that Paradox and Firaxis emerged, we can talk about the Paradox games all the time.
Oh, we should start an EU4 podcast.
It's a little late for that.
Well, maybe.
I would not have much in front of them to just sit here nodding.
That's okay.
I mean, we could talk about EU5 when it comes out. It's going to be a while yet, but, you know.
Based on what I've seen of Civ 5, I'm not so sure I want to play it, but who knows?
Civ 5?
Yeah, not Civ 5, EU5.
What? Yeah, there's still so much we need to... Civ 5 is still... Or EU5 is well in development still, so...
I think they have 3 whole development diaries at this point.
Yeah.
And they still won't call it EU5. See, yeah. I like Civ 5 so much that anytime you put a 5 at the end of the acronym, I will always say Civ instead of EU until I, like, 5 years from now.
There's not a lot of games that make it to 5 where 5 is...
still good?
Even decent. There's a lot that Civ 5 did that pissed me off, but yeah. Other than like maybe like Heroes of Might and Magic 5 was still pretty good. It's hard for me to come up with too many that make it that far.
Didn't make it much further than that, though.
Yeah, after HOM 5, it stopped existing, but 5 was pretty good still.
Considering it was made by a Ukrainian dev studio, or not Ukrainian, Siberian dev studio on extremely limited budget and stuff, it was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, man, it was. I if you go all time, I'd say it's maybe a little worse than HOM 3, but out of the ones I played, it's still way up there.
It's hard to beat HOM 3.
Yeah, and if you compare it to like unmodded HOM 3, I might actually prefer like the final iteration of unmodded HOM 5, because it had a lot of like handy quality of life things.
That might just be because it's newer.
Well, yeah. But still, like that's a testament to that its design was pretty good, like relatively close to HOM 3, that could be a difference maker.
Back in the days when game devs, even if they were very small studios, actually cared about their products.
That still happens today, it's just not happening in the games we're covering.
I don't know, Old World does a pretty good job.
Yeah, well, we weren't covering that today.
We didn't have time! Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright the Polycast at thepolycast.net.